And good morning. And welcome to The Other Villains of Passover, a two-part series. I'm grateful to Bethesda and Rebecca Grover for giving me the opportunity to come speak, and in so doing, forcing me to sort of coalesce some of my thoughts on the topic we're going to talk about this morning as well as next Monday. I greatly appreciate everybody being here at 10. This is useful. Not that we don't accept people after 10. If you have a cell phone and are able to please mute it or make it vibrate instead of ring, that would be helpful. Thank you. I wasn't sure who would come out because the Passover story is so familiar, and so much of it is already discussed and rediscussed and rediscussed year after year. But there's still so much to say, and actually I'll take the opportunity to note my program, the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash, is having a Haggadah night program. It's a free program. At Shari Shamayim is going to be on Monday, the 8th. Monday evening, the 8th of April. It will be at 8:15 p.m. And what we do is, there are four of us. We each speak for 10 minutes or less with a thought on the Seder. So you come away with an idea that you can repeat at the Seder. And then, again, that's Shari Shamayim, Monday evening at 8:15 p.m. But this idea is going to be a more than 10-minute idea. Still, I think, worthwhile. The other villains of Passover, I call this, because, of course, who's the main villain of Passover? Pharaoh, right? That's an easy one. And we talk about him all the time, which makes sense. At the same time, there are other people who come in for blame in the Pesach story, right? You already saw the title for the session, so it's cheating at this point, if I ask you, so who are the other villains? But the first one I mentioned comes in for blame in the Haggadah itself, and that is Laban. Then it mentions the second one, and that is Yehuda, Judah. I use the term villain for him advisedly because he's one of the heroes as well of Jewish history. But in the context of Passover, as I expect to discuss, we'll see him as a villain. And then finally, a fellow by the name of Datan. So we're going to have to talk about all three of them between this week and next week, and together they give us a picture of what the Jews are meant to accomplish in their Egypt experience, and why it's so important for Jewish history. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number one. Verses from Deuteronomy, basing myself on the way the Haggadah reads them, and I'll explain what I mean by that after we've read them. These are from a passage that's called Mikra Bikurim. Anyone know what Bikurim are? The first fruits. Right, the first fruits. Every year, those who live in Israel are supposed to take the first of their produce and bring it to the temple as a gift to the Kohen, as a gift to the priests. It's very funny, when I learned about this in day school, they always said the farmer, the farmer, the farmer. But it's not about the farmer. It's anyone who's growing produce in Israel, primarily the seven species for which Israel is known, wheat, barley, and so on. But you're supposed to bring them to the temple. They are a gift. And you're also supposed to recite verses. There is a reading. And that's what I translated for you here in source number one. This is what the grower of the produce says. You shall declare and say before Hashem your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my father. And he descended to Egypt, he dwelt there in small numbers, and there he became a large, mighty, and great nation. And the Egyptians harmed us and oppressed us and placed harsh labor upon us. And we cried out to Hashem, God of our ancestors, and God heard our voice. And he saw our oppression and our struggle and our strain. And God took us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and great awe and with signs and wonders. And he brought us to this place. And he gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Why is this a set of verses to say when you bring your first produce to the temple? Why is this appropriate? That's not a trick question. Sorry? Yeah.
Well, you're thanking God. You're in the land of milk and honey. You produce things.
Right. this is a digest of Jewish history. Right? You have to put it in our Haggadah. It's a digest of Jewish history. We went down to Egypt, we were slaves there, we got out, God brought us to this land, and now, look, I have this produce to give you, and here's my expression of gratitude. It's a summary of our national historical experience up until we came into the land. Fine. Why mention the Aramean in the beginning? So we're going to get to that in just one moment. One thing I did want to note for you is that the last sentence doesn't actually make it into the Haggadah. And meaning, this whole paragraph is in the Haggadah except for the last sentence. He brought us to this place, he gave us this land, the land flowing with milk and honey, because the Haggadah is telling the story of Passover. It's not talking about what happens 40 years later. But now I come back to the beginning of the paragraph. An Aramean tried to destroy my father. The truth of the matter is that the Hebrew is Arami Obeid Avi. Right? Arami, Aramean. Obeid, Aleph, Vav, Bet, Dalet. Avi, my father. The word Obeid is a problem. The word Obeid does not mean work. That's with an ayin, not an Aleph. What does the word Obeid mean? Lost, right? A lost object is an aveda. Arami obeyed. Now we're going to test our Hebrew grammar. What form is obeyed? Past, present, or future?
Present.
An Aramean
is
losing my father? Is destroying my father? Not quite. See, again, the grammar gets complicated, but then it should really be mi'aveid, which is a stronger form verb. It's not really obeyed. Obeyed is to be lost, not to cause something to be lost. So, an Aramean who is lost is my father. Well, now I don't know at all how to read it. So, Rabbi Shlomo ben Meir, also known as Rashbam, argued that this line should be read, my father was a wandering Aramean. Who would that be? Who was my ancestor who was a wandering Aramean? Abraham, good. Abraham was, in fact, from Aram. That's where he started out. And he went and he wandered. And in fact, he did descend to Egypt at one point. And that's one read of the sentence. Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra suggests it's actually Jacob. Because Jacob also did time in Aram when he ran away from home to escape his murderous brother. Right? He lived in the house of Laban, the Aramean, and he also was lost in Aram in the sense that Laban took advantage of it, which we're going to talk about. And so that's another read. But the Haggadah doesn't read it that way. The Haggadah takes a third read, and it says, an Aramean tried to destroy my father, meaning Laban attempted to destroy my ancestors. And so you take a look at source number 2, which is my translation of a contemporary standard Ashkenazi Haggadah. Go out and learn, right? Say Umat. Go out and learn what Laban the Aramean sought to do to Jacob, our father, since Pharaoh only decreed a death sentence on the males, but Laban sought to uproot the whole people. By the way, I put it as Laban, L-A-V-A-N, on the sheet, just because that's sort of standard. I'm going to keep on saying Laban. I hope it's not confusing. I apologize if it causes any trouble. But Laban is cast right at the beginning of the Haggadah as not only a villain, but worse than Pharaoh. Now, the genealogy of the Jewish people can be a little bit confusing, but not to people who live in Toronto. Because the Jews of Toronto have so married into each other's families that their families are far more confusing to me as a New Yorker who doesn't understand any of this. This is child's play. Consider. Laban's sister is whom? Sorry? His sister. Rebecca, right? Rebecca is Laban's sister, which means that Laban's brother-in-law is Isaac, which means that Laban's nephew is Jacob, right? He's Uncle Laban, if you will. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he has two daughters by the names of Rachel and Leah, from whom come almost all the Jews. right? I mean, we're going to see the kid born to Jacob in a little bit. But what you're talking about is responsibility for 8 out of the 12 tribes, right? 2/3 of the Jewish people are descended from Rachel and Leah, and therefore descended from Laban. That's really interesting. Right? He is very much a part of our lives as Jews. Take a look at source number 3. I found an article online by a fellow by the name of Harry Friedman. I don't know a whole lot about him besides what I read about him on his website, but he expressed what I was trying to express here. He says, Laban is certainly a trickster. He tricks Jacob into marrying Leah instead of Rachel. And according to Genesis 31:41, he changes Jacob's wages 10 times. We'll talk about that. Though what he actually did is not spelled out. But being a trickster is not so unusual in Genesis. Why is Laban singled out for special treatment? After all, as the father of Rachel and Leah, he is as much an ancestor of Israel as is Isaac. That's not quite true, because Jacob, being Isaac's son, means that all of the Jewish tribes are biological descendants of Isaac. Not all of them are biological descendants of Laban. We'll give him a pass on that. The point is that, as Harry Friedman says, we give Laban a really hard time. We say he is a villain who wanted to destroy everything. Worse than Pharaoh. That's an awful lot to put on somebody. So what I want to do is take a closer look at the story of Laban, as well as that of Judah, as well as that of Datan. And the result, as I said, is going to give us an insight, I think, into the entire Egypt experience, and in fact, into all of Jewish history. Clear so far? We've got Laban cast in the Haggadah as a villain based on the verses that are recited when you bring the first fruits, and I don't know what he could have done that would have been so bad that this is the way we should look at him. But in order to understand what happened with Laban, we need to take a step back and talk about how you build a nation. What makes for a national identity? This is a very interesting question in our times, right? In our increasingly xenophobic world. What makes for a national identity? What would you say?
I think language is one thing.
Language, for sure. Having a shared language. Sorry, what else?
Traditions.
Okay. That may get you into trouble in a multicultural nation, right? History, a shared history. One second, I can't hear it, right? Uh-huh.
Connection to the land
itself, Diane?
Well, they say a shared
crest. A shared crest. Interesting. I'm not touching you back. Yes. Yes. Food and money. Interesting. Food. Okay, I mean, I would put that in with traditions and say that you'll have potentially people who, in fact, eat their own diet and stick to wherever they came from. That creates a question. Would that make them no longer part of the same nation? What do you mean by money?
The currency.
Oh, the currency. Okay. Awesome. The currency. It's certainly true. Historically, governments would punish people if they didn't use the local currency.
Laws,
right? The laws of the land, loyalty to those laws. Take a look, please, at source number 4. Alvin Powell wrote an article, How to Build a Nation, building on and summarizing ideas from Dr. Francis Fukuyama, the famous political scientist. Francis Fukuyama, who in 1992 famously predicted, quote, the end of history, because liberal democracies and free market economies suggested an end point in the evolution of government. That didn't quite work out. Said that it never does. When people predict the end of history, it's just like asking, you know, it's like putting a target on your back, saying, history, prove me wrong. But anyway, he said that external forces can erect the skeleton of state in an embattled country, creating police forces, administrative structures, taxing authorities, but nation building goes further. and involves a shared sense of national identity, built on elements that tie people together, such as shared culture, language, and history. I don't think anyone mentioned history. Did someone did? Okay, sorry. That cannot be imposed from without. Fukuyama's point is that when we talk about identifying people as a nation, and it's been a big issue in the Middle East, think of Iraq as a prime example. When you want to identify a nation, you can't impose it. Even if you create all the structures that we associate with a national identity, currency, set of laws, dress, whatever it's going to be, fundamentally they have to have a shared culture, language, history. I gave you a reference in number 5, which is really worth reading. It's a study done by the Pew folks back in 2017 on the question of what makes someone part of a national identity. And they ranked people's responses and said that the top 4 things that people mentioned you need for national identity. Number 1 was language. Number 2 was shared customs and traditions, as in culture. Number 3, religious identity, which is very interesting. And number 4 was birthplace, which I would associate with history, origins, in general. But I would add one other element noted by Professor Ernest Gellner from the London School of Economics. In number 6, he's talking about nationalism, and he says, nationalism is not the awakening of nations to self-consciousness. It invents nations where they do not exist. And what he means by that is that a sense of association with that nation. It isn't enough that we have a shared history. It isn't enough that we went through the same things. It isn't enough that we speak the same language, that we eat the same food, that we wear the same clothing. We have to feel that we are one with those around us. And Gellner goes on, I didn't really bring enough of his quote. I should have brought more of it. But these factors are all necessary because they build towards one critical element. And that is trust. Take a look, please, at source number 7, Fukuyama's article, Social Capital and the Global Economy. He says, virtually all economic activity, from running a laundry to building the latest generation microprocess, is carried out not by individuals, but by organizations that require a high degree of social cooperation. As economists argue, the ability to form organizations depends on institutions like property rights contracts and a system of commercial law, but it also depends on a prior sense of moral community, that is, an unwritten set of ethical rules or norms that serve as the basis of social trust. For organizations to function, which translates into for your government to function, for your economy to function, for your school system to function, anything that you need in a nation, you need trust. And what we're going to see is that Laban, followed by Judah, followed by Dathan, undermine that trust. And our Egypt experience is meant to build up that trust. Follow? Okay. So let's now go back to Laban. Laban's main crime, that for which he is best known, is, we already referenced, the substitution of Leah for Rachel. In source number 8, which starts on one side and continues on the other, I gave you a quick translation, refresher for people. And Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I will work for you for 7 years, for Rachel, your younger daughter. It's fascinating. In the Hebrew, what he says is, I'll work for you for 7 years. Birachel, Bitcha, Hakitana. You can't be any more clear. Rachel, your daughter, the younger one. Oops. So Laban says, better that I give her to you than that I give her to another man. Stay with me. And Jacob worked for Rachel for 7 years. They were just a number of days in his eyes, in his love for her, how romantic. And Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are complete, and I will be with her. 7 years have passed. And Laban gathered all the people and he made a feast. And that evening he took his daughter Leah and he brought her to Jacob and he came to her. And Laban gave her his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. And it was in the morning and behold she was Leah. Right? Rabbinic commentary asks how is it that he didn't figure it out until the morning? Right? And they give this remarkable answer, which is based on this passage and other passages in the Torah, which is that there was some kind of a password. Right? Jacob knows who Laban is. Laban has a history. And he knows that there's a possibility of gamesmanship here. And so he thinks, I'm going to be smart. And he gives Rachel a code. Right? You've heard this before. He gives Rachel a code. When I say this, you say that. And so that's their method of getting around Laban. But Rachel feels bad at the last minute because Leah's going to be humiliated. Can you imagine? You go through the marriage, then he goes in, finds out it's Leah, it's going to destroy her. And so she gives Leah the code. And not only that, further version of it in the Midrash is bothered because, of course, their voices should be different. And suggests that Rachel actually is right outside, and Rachel speaks when Jacob asks. You know, when Jacob speaks, she's actually giving the response, lest Leah be humiliated. That's its own piece of the story. But in the morning, it's Leah, and he said to Laban, "What is it that you've done to me? Did I not work for you for Rachel? Why have you deceived me?" And Laban said, "That's not the way we do things here. Thus shall not be done in our place to give the younger before the elder. Complete this week, and we'll give you also this one for the work you shall do with me for another 7 years." You see the disdain with which he treats his daughters, right? I'll give you this one too. That's the word. Maleshua zos, v'nitznalacha gamet zos. Give you this one too. He doesn't even name her. And Jacob did this, and he completed that week, and Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to him as a wife. Incidentally, that's associated with the practice of? Not polygamy. But that is associated with it, right? Where you lift up the veil, check, right one? But also, Sheva Brachot. The practice that you have a week after the wedding, right, where they're just together and they celebrate, the fact that he has to wait a week before he can marry Rachel is to give Leah her week. So that's the swap. What motivated Laban to do it? Greed, right? It's straight greed. That's who this fellow is. And that's how Laban is perceived in general. This is a man who personifies greed. I gave you a couple of other examples of it. Take a look at source number 10. This is going on later, but Jacob has been very successful. Jacob heard the words of the sons of Laban, saying, "Jacob has taken all that our father possessed. From our father's property, he created all of this wealth." And Jacob saw Laban's face, that he was not with him as he had been previously. In other words, Laban is upset that Jacob is profiting, that Jacob is doing well. But the best example of it is source number 11. What a text this is. How about Kriya? I read from the Torah in the synagogue, and whenever I read this, like you just have to get drawn into the passion of this speech, number 11. This is after Jacob and his family left town. They said, "Laban doesn't like us. We're never getting out of here safely. We better flee." And they run away, the whole family. And Laban finds out, and he pursues them. And of course, Rachel took the trafim of her father, which is its own story. But he says, "Hey, you stole my trafim?" And he goes and he catches up with Jacob, and goes searching, does not find them. And then take a look at number 11. Look what Jacob says to Laban. "And Jacob was enraged, and he fought Laban. And Jacob declared to Laban, 'What is my rebellion? What is my sin that you lit out after me? You have felt through all of my implements. What have you found from all the implements of your house? Place it here before my brothers and your brothers. Let them demonstrate which of us is right. I've been with you for 20 years. Your lambs and goats never lost young. I never ate the rams of your sheep. I never brought a torn animal to you. I made up the loss.'" From my own hand you sought it, whether it was stolen by day or night. I was eaten by heat in the day and ice at night. Sleep flew from my eyes. I was in your house for 20 years. I worked for you for 14 years for your two daughters. 6 years for your sheep. You switched my salary 10 times. If not for the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the terror of Isaac being with me, you would have sent me off with nothing. My affliction and the work of my hands, God saw them and determined last night. Meaning, he said, "Don't." When he tells Laban, don't touch Jacob. That's this great, fantastic speech. And it's where the Torah reading ends. There's a break in the Torah portion. And you think, like, that's it. Like, what can you respond to a speech like this? And look what Laban says in the next verse. And Laban declared and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters. The sons are my sons." Presumably he means grandsons. "The sheep are my sheep. Everything you see is mine." Can you imagine? A chutzpah, he's totally Jewish. This guy's got a chutzpah. "And as far as my daughters, what would I do to them today? Or to the children they have birthed? Now let's make a pact." Dot, dot, dot. That is Laban's identity. He wants everything for himself. What does the word Laban mean? White. "I've done nothing wrong. I'm clean. I'm innocent. They're my daughters." Who, me? Butter would not melt on my tongue. Yes? Yeah. And that's basically what he did.
Is he a hero?
That's a really good question. The question is this. Jacob is getting tricked 10 times over, right, about salary, not to mention what happened with the wives. Why doesn't he just, tell him to go away, to put it politely? And that's the thing. In general, with Jacob, you find this remarkable tension throughout his life between wanting to avoid confrontation until the last moment when he has no choice. So you find it with his brother Esau, right? Esau wants to kill him. He runs away. When he comes back into Israel after this story, he sends messengers. He goes looking for Esau. But then he crosses the Yabok River at night, and according to the commentators who read the text carefully, it looks like he crosses it the other way. He's trying once again to avoid it. And it's only when God sends him this vision of an angel fighting with him and he's successful that he says, "Okay, I can do this." Jacob is not confrontational. You can read it into the two names he's given. Jacob, Yaakov, versus Yisrael. Yisrael is the name given to him for fighting with the angel. Jacob, Yaakov, was the name for grabbing the heel of his brother. Two different identities. One below, and the other one more confrontational. And there's a lot to be said about this within Jacob's identity. But here's my question. What's the impact of the substitution? Laban substituted substituted Leah for Rachel. What's the impact, besides 7 years of labor? He succeeded in marrying off the daughters. Okay, what else? What do you mean the children? Right, all of these children were born from not just the two women, but also the maids. Right? Because remember the way it works. Leah has 4 sons. It looks very rapid fire in the Chumash. It's this, and then this one, and then this one, and then like, there's time in between. Remember, they're there for 20 years. But in number 12, I brought you the order of the children. Leah has Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda. Rachel says, "What's going on? I'm not having any children. Where am I in the family?" And so she gives her maid Bilhah to Jacob. Bilhah produces 2 sons, Dan and Naphtali. Leah says, "That's a neat trick. And she gives Zilpah to Jacob, and so Zilpah produces Gad and Asher. Leah then produces Yisachar and Zebulun, until finally Rachel has Joseph after Leah has Dinah. Right? Then Rachel has Joseph, and then of course on their way back into Israel, Benjamin is born and Rachel dies. So you get all of these kids as a result of the swap. You don't have that competition. It's just Rachel. Right? What would have happened? Would Rachel have had 12? 13? Maybe. Not clear. Maybe. But what else does it cause? What else did Laban create? Yeah.
Future histories and identities coming from different origins.
Future histories and identities coming from the fact that they have different origins,
Gloria?
Tribes. Tribes. Tribes and tribalism. This leads to strife. Take a look, please, at source number 13. After Leah has had her four sons, and Rachel saw she had not birth to Jacob, Rachel became jealous of her sister. She said to Jacob, "Give me children, if not I shall die." Lashing out at Jacob, who of course says, "What am I supposed to do?" Right? Which is really, that's a painful moment in their history, because Jacob's response, he gets criticized for this response. His response to her is, "Am I in God's place?" That's not exactly the response you want to his wife, who's suffering and upset. But that's number one. And then number two, take a look at source number 14. The story of what are called in Hebrew the Dudaim. They're usually translated as mandrakes, for lack of a better translation. Might as well translate them as Dudaim, since I wouldn't know a mandrake if it bit me. But Reuben went during the wheat forest. He found mandrakes in the field. He brought them to his mother Leah, and Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me from your son's mandrakes." Why does she want mandrakes? Right, they're supposed to somehow help her to be able to have a child. It's a competition that goes on between Rachel and Leah, and look what happens. Flip the page. Look what Leah says to her. When Rachel wants these dudaim, these mandrakes, Leah says back to her, "Hama'at ha'cheret ishi, v'lakacha gama dudaim b'ni. Is it a small thing that you took my husband and now you will take my son's mandrakes?" Can you imagine? Leah says to her, "You took my husband?" What book are you reading? The other way around. You took him. You took her husband. And especially with that added idea that Rachel helped her by giving her the passwords. But that's the strife that you get. And Rachel ends up saying, "Fine, he can be with you tonight." And it's not just here. It continues from here. It creates multiple camps among Jacob's children and their descendants. Yes, Hannah?
The relationship actually doesn't have anything to do with them, but you see that God is in charge of it. Because it's written, "Vayashem, and that's why he gave
the children." Okay, so. Right. But what are you saying? You're right. God is controlling the whole story. That's for sure. But that doesn't absolve Laban of what he does. Right? Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple as God wants him to. He's still responsible. Yes. Yes. Got it. Mandrake the magician. A valid point. Look what happens as a result of what Laban does. It's not just the strife between Rachel and Leah. It's not only the creation of all of these different tribes. Take a look, please, at source number 15. People miss this. When Jacob is preparing for the battle that he thinks is coming with his murderous brother Esau, and Jacob raised his eyes and saw Esau coming and 400 men with him. Remember that 400 biblically is not a good sign. Generally speaking, 40s and 400s tend to be associated with bad things coming. And he split the children between Leah, Rachel, and the two maids. So who goes first? He placed the maids first with their children. Leah, her children after them. Rachel and Joseph after them. You're anticipating a fight. Who'd you put first? Bilhah, Zilpah, and their boys. Next, Leah and her boys. Next, Rachel and her boys. What message are you sending? Right, the ones who are least defensible, right? That's the way it works. It's also interesting, a complete side note that we can't really address here now, but I want to at least note it. Do you notice that Leah, Rachel, and the two maids, sometimes they're wives, sometimes they're described as maids. It may have to do with how they're being treated in that particular scene. Here, they're being put first. I don't want to use the phrase canon father, I think that's a little too harsh, but they're the ones who are being put first in line against what we think of as a potentially hostile army. Yes?
We haven't been talking about the problems that came because Joseph had faith.
Oh, no, we're getting there. We're getting there. We're just not there yet in history. Diane. True, Rachel could have been pregnant, then we should have said that as the reason. Right? This hierarchy is one that isn't only here. As a matter of fact, it's a passage I didn't bring on here. After Rachel dies, right? Right after Rachel dies, in Genesis chapter 35, we are told, as the text indicates and the Talmud expands, that Reuven moves his father's bed. After each of the wives has their own tent, Reuven sees that his father, after Rachel dies, moves his bed into Bilhah's tent. And that's too much for Reuven to take. And so he moves the tent from the bed, from Bilhah's tent, to his mother Leah's tent, earning himself criticism because it's not for you to mess with a kid. But the point again is the sense that develops of multiple camps. And then you move into Parshat Vayeshev, where we discuss the sale of Joseph. And take a look at how that's introduced in source number 16. These are the children of Jacob. Joseph was 17 years old, herding the sheep with his brothers. And he was a Na'ar. Na'ar can mean youth. Na'ar can mean servant. With the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Notice that they're wives now. But that's not my point. My point is, Joseph is hanging out with the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. Not with the children of Leah. Different camps. And it continues generations later. Take a look at source number 17. The beginning of the book of Numbers is a census. The census is carried out by the leaders of the tribes. Look how the leaders of the tribes are presented in source number 17. I didn't bring you the verses, I just brought you each one. It lists the leaders. Reuben, Shimon, Yehuda. Levi is skipped because they're not in the census. The Levites are counted separately. They're not in the military. Yisachar, Zebulun. Those are all the sons of Leah. Then Joseph, broken down into Ephraim and Manasseh, his two sons. Then Benjamin. Those are Rachel. Then Dan and Asher, who were from Bilhah, and then Gad and Naphtali, who were from Zilpah. You see what I'm saying? Each, they're not in each order. Each wife's children are identified separately, and the same thing continues in number 18. We find out the camps of the Jews as they traveled in the wilderness on their way from Egypt into Israel. This is centuries after the split. This is centuries after the whole story of Laban. The Jews camp in a square around the Mishkan, around the tabernacle. First you have Levi that camps close to the Mishkan, close to the tabernacle, and then around them you have a square. Each side of the square has three tribes. Your first one, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, sons of Leah. Your second one, Reuven, Shimon, and Gad, because you have a problem. You don't have enough sons of Leah. Right? There should be. There are six of them, but one of them is Levi. They're not going to count. So you throw in Gad, which was from Zilpah, Leah's maid. Then you have the Levites. Then you have Ephraim, Manasseh, Benjamin, that's Joseph. And Dan, Asher, Naphtali, that's the rest of the maids, Bilhah and Zilpah. Once again, the division into units based on which family line they come from. And this will be important throughout Tanakh. The story of Shimshon, of Samson, right, who fights against the Philistines. What tribe is he from? Anyone know? Dan. Samson is from Dan. Who is Dan's mother in all of this? Bilhah, right? Dan's mother is Bilhah. At one point, the Philistines come to the people of Judah, where Shimshon is living, where Samson is living, and say, turn him over. And they do. They turn over Samson to the Philistines. He cooperates. But my point isn't his cooperation. My point is Judah from Leah versus Dan, who is from Bilhah, Rachel's maid. The end of the book of Judges records the story of a civil war between the tribe of Benjamin and the rest of the Jews. The tribe of Benjamin, from Rachel, believes the rest of the Jews are out to get them. It goes on in the book of Samuel, when a man by the name of Sheva ben Bichri takes advantage of a split between Judah on the other hand, and the northern kingdom, what would become the northern kingdom, led by descendants of Rachel. You find it over and over and over again. King Solomon has a son named Rehoboam who takes over the throne. Solomon is from which tribe? Judah, right? Which is from Leah. Who is the one who rips away the 10 tribes from Solomon? Yerubbaal ben Nebat. The Assyrians won't be on the scene for ages. Yerubbaal ben Nebat, who is descendant of Ephraim, which is from Rachel. The Jews split into a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. It's a split between the descendants of Rachel and Leah. What Laban has done, and I hope at this point it's clear, what Laban has done is he's triggered a terrible schism that begins among our nation's founders and just continues from there. He is much more than a greedy guy who got 7 years of extra work out of Jacob. He created an us versus them mentality among the Jewish people. What Fukuyama was talking about, the need for trust, right? The need for a sense of association, to feel like we are all one, is shattered by Laban. And so, to go back to where we were in the beginning, Laban is the Aramee who seeks to uproot everything. You could take that as when he goes running after Jacob. You could take it that way. But his result, intentional or not, is much bigger. Because he undermines our trust and indirectly creates an ongoing us versus them situation within the Jewish people. That's Laban. You already have a nice red cover for your Seder. It may take you 45 minutes to repeat it, but we have more to say. I think it can be condensed probably. There was a hand. Yeah?
I don't think he was the only one who did that. I mean, Abraham did it. Everyone did it.
Yeah, absolutely.
They didn't have children who loved each other and were good to each other. Everyone was at war with each other.
Right. This is an important point, and it's going to emerge again when we talk about the sale of Joseph, which is where we're going, so I'll mention it already now. Laban is not the first to trigger a division. The difference between Laban and his predecessors is that he triggers a division among those who weren't supposed to be divided. Meaning, when Sarah says, send away Ishmael, because Lo Yirash ben Ha'amazot in B'yim Yitzhak, he's not part of the line. He is not going to continue the family along with my son, Isaac. It's a statement of, he's not meant to be part of the group, and God goes along with it. Because Abraham doesn't want to do it, and God says, do it. God says, whatever Sarah tells you, go ahead. Ishmael is meant to see himself as a nation apart. Ditto Jacob and Esav, right? Where again, it gets the divine approval of give the blessing to Jacob, give the birthright to Jacob. Esav is going to get Har Seir. He'll get Mount Seir in the south. He will live in the area of Edom. He'll do very well for himself, but also not part of the family. These are supposed to be part of the family. So you're right. Absolutely, he's not the first, and we're going to see that when we talk now about the sale of Joseph. Let's come to Judah. And again, I have a hard time labeling Judah a villain because of who he becomes. But you'll see what I mean as we go through the story. Take a look, please, at source number 19. The brothers are grazing the sheep. Jacob sends Joseph. Says, go see how your brothers are doing. Go see how the sheep are. And they saw him from afar. And before he could draw near, that's just say near, sorry. Before he could draw near, they plotted to kill him. And one said to his brother, behold, a dreamer is coming. Let's go kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we'll send it a wild beast in. We'll see what comes of his dreams. Right? The dreams of everybody bowing to him. Who are these two brothers? And one said to his brother. We got a lot of brothers to choose from. Who are these two? Can't be a reference to all of them. They can't be, they all said to each other. Because we're going to see that Reuven objected to the plan. And Judah objected to the plan. So it's not that all the brothers are saying, let's kill them. So who is it? So Rashi takes you on a process of elimination in source number 20. Rashi's comment comes when Jacob gives his blessing to his children, but he curses Shimon and Levi. You know, jump to 21 for a second, because it'll help to make it clear. This is what he says, what Jacob says on his deathbed to Shimon and Levi. He says, Simon and Levi are brothers. Tools of violence are their weapons. In their secrets, my spirit will not enter. In their counsel, my honor will not be degraded. For in their anger, they killed a man, and at will, they uprooted an ox. Which of Joseph, of Jacob's children is known as the ox? Joseph. Joseph's symbol is the ox. Cursed be their rage, for it is strong, and their anger, for it is harsh. I will split them among Jacob, I will scatter them among Israel. Which in fact is what happens. Shimon, when the Jews come into the land of Canaan, doesn't get a portion. They get cities among the tribe of Judah. Amid the tribe of Judah. Levi does not get a portion. They get cities scattered all the way around the land. It's a fulfillment of what Jacob predicted. But now go back to number 20. Rashi says, Simon and Levi are brothers. They were in one clan regarding Shechem and Joseph. Shechem, the city that they destroyed for taking Dinah, and Joseph. And one said to his brother, let us go kill him. Who were they? Who is the one who said it to the brother? Rashi says, process of elimination. Reuben and Judah did not agree to the murder, so it couldn't be them. The sons of the maids, Bilhah and Zilpah, did not fully hate Joseph. As it is written, he was a youth with the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. Rashi believes that they're playing together. They're hanging out together. So they wouldn't have said kill him. Yisachar and Zebulun, the two youngest sons of Leah, would not have spoken before their elder brothers. So it must have been Simon and Levi, whose father called them brothers. Should have been in number 21. Simon and Levi are brothers. Rashi believes Simon and Levi, Shimon and Levi, are the ones who decide to kill Joseph. So here's my question. Why do the other brothers go along with the plan? If it's not their plan, if it's just Simon and Levi, why do the others go along with it? Fear? Could be. You don't mess with Simon and Levi. You don't want to end up like Shechem.
Jacob favored Joseph.
Jacob favored Joseph. Right? You can't get around that. There are different views as to what the cause is. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, who I quoted in number 22, says it's Jacob's fault. Because the opening verses of this section of the Torah actually starts These are the descendants of Jacob. Joseph was the story with the special tunic and so forth. It's the offspring of Jacob. It's the events of Jacob because of what Jacob did. That's the way that Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra looks at it. He says, Jacob is the one who is the major player. He pities Joseph. He overcompensates in order to favor him, leading the brothers to fear for their own futures. That's one way to look at it. Rashi says no. It's actually the brothers themselves who are at fault because of their jealousy of each other. So Rashi says in number 23, the first cause, Joseph was 17, led to their descent to Egypt, meaning he was young and he acted like it. He was a youth, he acted like a youth, fixing his hair, rubbing his eyes, wanting to make himself look good. That's the way that Rashi reads the story, is that Joseph has some responsibility, and he continues in the rest of number 23. That Joseph is with the sons of Bilhah, meaning he regularly stayed with the sons of Bilhah because his brothers, the other brothers, mocked him. And he drew them close, creating an alliance. He brings speech about their bad conduct to their father. Whenever he saw that and his brothers, the sons of Leah, he told his father. That's the way Rashi looks at it, is that it's the hostility between the brothers. Rabbi Naftali Yehuda Berlin has yet another take. He says, no. We misread a sentence, he argues. If you go back for a second to... One second. Yes, number 16. These are the children of Jacob. Joseph was 17 years old, herding the sheep with his brothers. And he was a Na'ar with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah. Na'ar, argues Rabbi Berlin, was not a youth hanging out with them. He was made to serve them. Joseph is made to serve the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. Leah's sons are abusing Joseph. And that Joseph tells the dreams to his brothers, trying to get close to them. When you tell someone what you're dreaming about, you're sharing something that's intimate about yourself. Joseph thinks this is a way to develop a bond, and all he succeeds in doing, though, is antagonizing them. But all of your explanations, whether you blame Jacob, whether you blame Joseph, whether you blame the brothers collectively, however you read the story, it all comes down to an us versus them mentality. And yes, it's understandable, because look at the family they come from. Right? Think about it. You are one of these brothers. Okay? Nina's not involved. Nina didn't do this. So you have to pick a brother instead of me. You're looking at the scene. My grandfather, Isaac, succeeded. His brother was booted out. My father, Jacob, succeeded. His brother was booted out. Huh. Well, I look around my family, and I see Joseph getting all sorts of special treatment, with dreams of grandeur, and a special tunic, and he hangs out with Dad. And I think to myself, how long is it going to be before I get booted out? Instead of seeing themselves as a unit, it becomes us versus them. Reuben, to his credit, says, don't do it. Take a look at source number 25. Reuben heard the plan against Joseph. He saved him from their hands, saying, do not strike him mortally. Reuben told him, do not spill blood and throw him in this pit in the wilderness. Do not send your hand against him, so that he could save him from their hand, returning him to his father. Reuben's idea is, if he ends up in a pit, then when they all leave, I can come back and get Joseph out. And then Reuben leaves. He's not there on the scene for the sale. Reuben's gone at that point. Midrash says he's gone to go take care of their father, but he's not on the scene during the sale. He doesn't know what happens. But then up steps Judah. And look at Judah's proposal. Take a look at source number 26, please. When Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the striped tunic he wore. They took him and cast him into the pit. The pit was empty without water. And they sat to eat bread. They raised their eyes and saw, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit would there be if we would kill our brother and cover his blood? Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Let our hands not be upon him. He is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. And then Reuben comes back to the pit, and of course it's too late. Joseph is gone. Judah causes the sale of Joseph. Good guy or bad guy? I'm hearing good over here. Nancy's saying bad over there. Cold comfort. Yes. Good and bad? Maybe. Maybe. You can look at it differently. Sorry. You're going to say? No? The truth of the matter is, you can look at it different ways. Yes, he thinks, he doesn't know what he's thinking about coming back for him, right? He thinks this is an upgrade. He isn't going to die in the pit. He'll survive. But what Judah could have done was to say, "Guys, wrong. Don't do it." Right? That's what he could have done, and he didn't do so. And now, not only have they gotten rid of Joseph, but they turned a profit on it. The prophet, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, weighed very harshly about this. Take a look at source number 27. The prophet Amos, who often speaks out about social justice, picks on the Joseph story multiple times in his book. I just brought one example, the most famous one. He says, "So declares God, for three sins of Israel, for four I shall not repent." I'm going to punish them. I'm not going to forgive them. What the three and the four are is its own discussion, not for right now. "For selling the righteous for silver and the pauper for shoes." That is understood as a reference to the sale of Joseph. "They trample into the ground the heads of the indigent. They warp the path of the humble. A man and his father go to a girl to desecrate my holy name. They lean back on clothing taken as collateral beside every altar. They drink the wine of those they punish in the house of their God, taking advantage of the vulnerable for their own enrichment." It's all traced back to the sale of Joseph. So much so, the Talmud in source number 28 notes that the next section in the Torah begins, "At that time, Judah descended." What do you mean he descended? He descended because the brothers no longer respected him. Once the fever of "let's get rid of Joseph" wore off, and they saw the pain they had inflicted on their father, and what they had done to their family, they looked at Judah and said, "Where was your leadership? What did you do? You told us to sell him? And we would get money for it?" And they demote Judah. Now, Judah redeems himself. Right? What happens at the end of the story with Joseph, where Judah redeems himself? What does he do? He offers himself up. But not only that, it's a perfect replay of this story in reverse. Joseph has this really, people don't realize what Joseph accomplishes in his manipulation of the brothers. He creates a situation in which, once again, the son of Rachel versus all the rest. And the son of Rachel appears to have done something wrong, to have stolen Pharaoh's goblet. So the brothers would be very justified in saying, "Let him rot. We'll save ourselves. He did something wrong." And instead, the son of Leah, Judah, instead of saying, "Sell him," says, "Take me instead." He puts himself on the line this time. He rights the wrong. But my point here, just because I have a minute and a half left, my point here is this. Right now, Judah has not redeemed himself. The story with Tamar hasn't happened yet, the story with Benjamin hasn't happened yet. At this stage, he has deepened the schism among the Jews. The split that started because of Rachel and Leah, because of love on swap, gets worse now. Because now, a son of Leah has sold a son of Rachel for cash. And so that makes things even worse. And this, ultimately, as I want to discuss next week, is what takes the Jews down to Egypt. It's the split between us that causes us to have to go. What we'll see next time, God willing, will be the story of Datan. Datan and Aviram, because he's always around with his partner in crime. But what we'll also see is how the experience in Egypt and what we do at the Seder are meant, on the one hand, to reverse what Jacob and Laban and Datan did, and at the same time, to preserve certain elements of it. Because there are elements of the split that we actually decide to preserve. So there's a lot to be said next week. This week was very heavy on the biblical text. Next week is going to be much heavier on the Haggadah, the Egypt experience. But between the two, hopefully we'll come out with a coherent picture. I saw that there was at least one hand still up. I'll stick around to discuss things further. Thank you very much.